Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, this is Craig. If you're a musician, I made a special three-question survey for you at everyonelovesguitar.com/survey. Again, musicians only, complete this three-question survey at everyonelovesguitar.com/survey. Alrighty now, let's do this. Hey everybody, this is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. Got a great guitarist with us, super interesting woman, Angie Swan, who's just been out with David Byrne for, you said 11 months?
About 10, 11 months, yeah.
That's a major tour with a major artist. Angie's a multi-instrumentalist born and raised in Milwaukee, which is where she is right now. After graduating from Milwaukee High School of the Arts, she went on to study at Berklee. While attending college, she actually toured the UK with a Brooklyn-based band called the Femme Nameless, opening for Femi Kuti at Barbican Center in London. After leaving Berklee, she fast-tracked it to LA, where she played guitar for artists such as will.i.am, Nicole Scherzinger, Boney James, Stevie Wonder, Alana Grace, and Wax. She auditioned for and was invited to join the Cirque du Soleil production of Alma Luna, touring throughout the U.S. and Canada for 3 years. And in 2017, she toured Asia with pop sensation girl group Fifth Harmony in Argentina and Brazil with five-time Grammy Award-winning CeeLo Green. Since March of 2018, as I said, she's been playing with David Byrne on the American Utopia Tour. I've talked to a number of musicians who've seen that, and they love the show. She's also been in the house band on guitar and vocals for BET Black Girls Rock Awards Ceremony, MTV's Rock the Cradle, and she's currently working on her debut EP, and we're going to talk about that later today. And thanks so much for coming on the show, Angie. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Good to be here.
Did you, I just realized on the Black Girls Rock, was Kat Dyson on there as well?
Kat wasn't on there the year I was. They just had one guitar player each year. Okay. I was there, I think, 1 or 2 years ago. I was there not this past August, but I think the year before that.
Very cool. So, I'm assuming that was a great kind of experience to participate in.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was awesome. Just a lot of great musicians. For instance, Divinity Rocks, bass player from Beyonce's original all-girl group. So, yeah, it was just a lot of different people from all over. And we just rehearsed for a week, learned all the songs for different artists, and went ahead and did it.
Very cool. I read in an article where you mentioned something about the most important thing you need to do to grow as a musician is to get out of wherever you're living. I was curious how you learned that. And also, since you've left Milwaukee, what are, let's say, maybe the top two or three things you've learned from traveling and from going abroad?
Well, I think that, you know, that's actually a really good question. And the irony of that is that I am back in the town that I grew up in.
That's all right.
What I learned and how I'm able to do that, because I mean, my cost of living is substantially less than a lot of my colleagues in both Los Angeles and New York. You can't just stay in one place, especially if you come from a small city like myself. You have to use the tools that you acquire amongst your travel. You know, I was just networking everywhere I went. I networked. I lived in Boston for 5 years. And I moved to Los Angeles and so on, just traveled from there. You know, I kind of planted seeds everywhere I went. I always keep in touch with people, you know, keep good relationships with people. And, you know, it's kind of funny. People call me now. They're like, well, where do you live? And I'm like, I live wherever you need me to live. You know, if the gig's worth it, I can go out to it. I still have a storage unit in LA because I always thought I'd move back there. But, you know, I mean, I think it's a great place to visit. And if you have a big gig or something that's steady, like maybe a TV show, house band or something, I think that'd be a good place to go. Also, you know, during the downtime, it's just less stressful to live in a less expensive place.
Oh, God, yeah.
And also, I'm closer to family. Chicago's not too far away. And like I said, I still go to LA probably about 4 or 5 times a year for different projects.
I like what you said. You said, hey, where do I live? Wherever the gig is, wherever the job is. So you're, mm-hmm. I, one of the things I've learned about from interviewing like close to 400 players is how, I mean, what you guys do is really hard. This is not, you know, to pick up and say, hey, I'll, you know, you need me to move to LA, you need me to move to New York, you need me to move to Brooklyn, to Paris, where that's a huge commitment to your career to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think it's good to have a good foundation and home base wherever you're at. And that's why I, you know, kind of kept this place here in Wisconsin, because it's away from all the craziness.
Yeah.
But again, I have like a lot of connections and friends. If I have to go somewhere, you know, I can either stay with a friend or get an Airbnb. And, you know, usually if I get called out for a gig in another city, I'll try to line up some studio sessions or other stuff just to supplement the cost of me going out there. Also, it's really good to keep track of your expenses. When you go on the road, I would always, you know, save those flyer miles. You never know. After a few months on the road, you can acquire miles, which will, you know, equal another ticket somewhere, maybe to get you to your next gig.
Okay. So you just said a bunch of stuff there that was real interesting. You line up studio sessions wherever you go. Man, you're a real hustler. I like that. I really.
Well, my joke is I say, when I'm not working, I'm working on working.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean,
you know, I've been on the road with David Byrne for the past 10, 11 months. Mm. I started looking for my next job back in June.
Right.
Did I find it? No. But but you really have to kind of plan in advance in this type of industry, because you never know what's coming next. So you just got to be smart, you know, smart with your hustles. I mean, I don't even call it a hustle. I just call it, you know, just working towards the next project. And, you know.
So you're definitely super organized, I would imagine.
No, I'm actually very disorganized.
No way. You seem but, like you're like boom, 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 boom.
Yeah, I say this. This is my theory. No, I say, well, I've gotten more organized over the years. It's just, you know, it's definitely trial and error. When, you know, I've made some of the same mistakes more than once, sometimes more than twice. And then you just have to really get on yourself and say, okay, that I'm not going to let that happen again. I don't want to be back in this position. For instance, like finances, like I've had some pretty big tours before. Maybe I didn't save the way I should have,
yeah.
You know, to build a cushion or even invested, you know, just to have, you know, to diversify the assets,
yeah.
and things you make over time. So I was lucky enough for this tour. I actually, you know, kind of set myself up. I'm like, all right, I don't want to end up how I did after the last tour. So what can I do to give myself a cushion for 6 to 9 months after this tour? So it's just, yeah. So that's, I am organized in that respect, definitely. But I still have problems like rolling up patch cords and cables.
So has most of, I was going to say to you, where did you learn, like, just to have that awareness, a lot of musicians don't have it, like about, okay, I need to make sure I save up. I need to make sure that once I save up, maybe I could diversify some money and I'm, you know, have at my assets working for me. Where did you learn this stuff? Like, where did that come from? Or did you learn it by just not doing it the first time and saying, shit, I got to like jump on something here?
Well, it was a little bit of both. You know, like I said, in my 20s, it was definitely trial and error of not saving, you know, just spending everything you got and not thinking about the next day and what if this doesn't work out or what if I get injured or any of that stuff. So, yeah, I learned it over time, just kind of on my own and just listening to people. I actually did a CES Consumer Electronics Show this past year in Las Vegas with Intel, and they were beta testing Invisible Instruments. And these, I'm working
on
these. Yeah, we can get into that.
That's so cool.
So I played the world's first like invisible electric guitar, which is still like brand new. It's pretty much how Atari was in the 70s,
very basic,
but it's still very cool. So just hanging out around those tech guys, you know, they start talking a lot about cryptocurrency. You know, I read into that. So I threw a little in there, and then I kind of also invest in companies that I believe in. And, you know, I just started reading books on it and just, you know, like I said, diversifying and just trying to, you know, just have a plan B, have a plan C, and just, you know, not ever, you know, just keep moving upwards and forward. So that's just basically my goal, is to not be how I was the year before.
Yeah, man, that's really cool. That's really great to hear. Let me ask you this. You said that you're always networking. That's a hot topic for people, mm-hmm. For musicians. And there's always that sort of like balance between being genuine when you're networking and just like kind of pimping yourself out. And then like, it's apparent you're pimping yourself out and then you don't feel good about it. How do you like have a Rolodex or something? You say, okay, I need to call back this person and this person periodically. Or do you just make sure like I know if I read something, for instance, that I think somebody would be interested in, I'll send it to that person.
Yeah, yeah. Well, for me, you know, networking, I don't even, you know, the term, it sounds a little too...
I know.
It sounds too mechanical.
Yes.
When I say networking, I mean, just don't be an asshole and maintain genuine relationships with people. When I was younger, yeah, I had to network because people didn't know who I was. Like, hey, yeah, nice to meet you. But now I like to work with people that I feel like I click with. Like I say, I like to work with someone I can have a beer with after work. That's really important to me. Cause it translates on stage, it translates in music. And so what I mean by networking is just keeping in touch with your friends, you know, even don't just call them when they're doing great, call and check in on people. I think that's very important because I've wanted those calls before and I have friends that call me, and it's not just when you're up on your chips, you gotta, you know, constantly maintain connections with people because this industry will drive you crazy and you become really quickly. So I keep a tight network of close friends, and that was kind of hard because I have such good friends, but they're all spread out. So there's not like one city where I can say, all right, when I come here, I've got 10, 20 close friends. So again, that's probably why I like to travel so much, because pretty much everywhere we go, I have a really good colleague or friend. And
right.
You know, that could stem from, you know, the music school I went to. It's broadened the network a lot.
Yeah.
Or other shows I've played with. So, yeah. When I say network, I really mean just keeping connections with people that you, you know.
Yeah, I know that whole the network. You say networking, you think like life insurance and realtors and life insurance and a meeting at 4 o'clock, you know, having happy hour or something like that.
Happy hour is great. No, that's my other thing. I'll take a glass of scotch at 4 or 5 o'clock. That's usually a conversation starter right there. People are like, you're so tiny and you know your scotches and you love your scotches. I'm like, yeah, that's my thing.
I love scotch. What do you drink? What's your scotch? What's your whiskey?
Well, it's funny. I'm a McKellen fan. Mm-hmm. And when we were on tour with David, we actually went up. I wanted to go to the McKellen Distillery. We were in Scotland, but couldn't get there. It was too far, but went to the Oban.
Yeah, yeah. That's in Oban's a peaty that's up in that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We went to the distillery up there, but the crazy thing is the night before I was hanging out in Glasgow, Scotland with some guys from another band, and I should have known. I'm like 120 pounds, 5'4". And they're like, Angie, you shouldn't go drink for drink with a Scottish man. And I was out with rhythm. So the bumpy ride 2 hours up the coast the next day.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. I was so nauseous, but I held it together. But
how was the tour? Was it cool?
Oh, my God. The tour was great. I just got off it like 4 days ago. I just got back from Australia. It was like a 27-hour trip.
Holy cow.
I'm just still kind of decompressing and getting over this jet lag, and I need time to just reflect. I'm taking the whole month of December just to kind of reflect on everything, because we did about 144 shows in 27, 28 countries.
Wow.
And it's funny because I keep saying that's how many shows we did. When I was with Cirque du Soleil, we did about 330 shows a year. But with Cirque, you move like every couple months. With David's show, you're moving every couple days. So,
holy crap. That's like serious frequent flyer miles.
Yeah, well, a lot of it was on the bus too, but I definitely kept up with those miles. And I think with flying, we did about, they said, three times around the world.
Wow, that's amazing.
Total miles, yeah.
So what was it?
90,000.
Good for you. That's awesome. What was your favorite place you went to?
You know, a lot of the places we had been to, I had been to before on other tours. I always enjoy Rio, you know, Brazil. We were in Brazil in March. That was awesome. We did, I did Rock in Rio, but that was with CeeLo. I did Rock in Rio with CeeLo last September, and then just did Rio with David in March. So that, you know, Rio de Janeiro is awesome. I love France. It was my first time in Australia, New Zealand. I especially love New Zealand. It's just such a beautiful place and people are nice. And yeah, you know, the food's great. I like to try food every place I go. I have to try something different. That keeps it exciting.
Well, you're lucky with your 120 pounds. You must have a rapid fire metabolism. That's great.
We'll see how long that metabolism stays like this.
You'd probably be fine for a while. How did you tour the UK while you were still a student at Berkeley?
Well, I went out there for just a short one. This is kind of funny. I think it was my second year at school. When I was at Berkeley, Esperanza Spalding and Annie Clark, who most people know as St. Vincent, they were also at Berkeley at the same time. So, you know, you're just surrounded by all these awesome people. And that's just to name a few of the people that were there. Esperanza and I were, I believe we were in a class together, and she asked me to join this band. She was playing bass for it. And she's like, yeah, they need a guitar player. This band in Brooklyn, which, you know, which is about 4 or 5 hours south of Boston. And I said, yeah, I'll do it. And it was like Afro funk stuff, like Fela Kuti type music. And we, you know, we opened for her son, Femi. And so Esperanza and I would take a bus. I think it was called the Chinatown bus down from Boston. After school, we take a bus 5 hours south to New York City to rehearse for 2 hours and then take a bus 5 hours back up to go to class the next day.
Holy, and, that's like, wow.
Yeah. So we did that for a few weeks. This was when I was young. I had that kind of,
I was going to say, that's only the kind of thing you do when you're young. Cause like if someone said it to me now, I don't care how much kind of money's there. I'm not interested in doing that.
Yeah. And I don't even think that gig paid that well. I don't remember, but it was just such a great experience. And the thing is we left school maybe for about a month and a half, and we had to tell all our professors and like ask, oh, can we go to this? And we're like, you know, this is kind of what you're going to school for, is to get out and have these types of experiences. So, you know, some professors were cool about it. Others were like, well, you're going to miss a lot of class. And I said, well, if I don't go, I'll miss a lot of experience.
Yeah, that's weird that they wouldn't be supportive, like immediately supportive of that.
Well, like I said, some weren't. You know, I think, you know, sometimes just give you a hard time, but it was, you know, it ended up being great. It was fine. And, you know, that was my first time leaving the continental U.S. I had been to Mexico before when I was like 14, but, you know, this is my first time flying overseas. And so, you know, I definitely had to go to that. And I remember getting out of Heathrow Airport and almost getting hit by a car right away because the car was
going the wrong way. Yeah,
exactly. And so that was like my first memory of that. But
did you drive? Did you drive when you were over there?
It's funny you say, I actually tried to. I think it was in Birmingham. We had met some people and I was just joking. I was like, yeah, I'd love to drive. And they said, oh, okay, yeah, try it. And I got in the car, I probably drove about 20 feet. And then I was like, no.
The roundabouts are just like really hard to navigate.
Yeah, it's so backwards and twisted to me. But, you know, I've gotten used to it now. I've been to like the UK so many times. And was it Australia? I think Australia was like that too. Yeah, the cars. So
that's wild. Yeah. What did you learn on that early tour? Like from a business standpoint and, I mean, that was your first road gig.
My first gig, yeah.
What did you learn? What are the most important takeaways you got out of that?
Well, this is kind of weird. I think, yeah, it was kind of cold. Take care of your hands because, you know, this was like a low budget tour. We're carrying our own gear and stuff. And you know, I think I clipped my finger or something. And you know, always have gloves when it's cold outside. It's just little stuff. Like I think with my mother, like wear your scarf, wear your gloves. But, you know, as a guitar player, you really got to protect your hands. Like it was so long ago. I mean, there were just, you know, just camaraderie and traveling internationally with large groups. There are always going to be the stragglers, people who go slow and people go fast. One thing, packing, you know how to pack for a place. You know, some people overpack. I tend to, well, actually I just did Europe for a month and a half. Europe, Hong Kong, and Australia, a month and a half in a carry-on. So I learned how to pack. I was a horrible packer when I was younger, so that's what I was getting at. I'd say just take what you need. Don't overpack because it gets stressful trying to move around. So
carrying all them bags or heavy bags.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, and also know about your different power outlets in different countries. Yes, that's what happened. I fried a pedal. Yeah, I remember that smell. I fried a pedal in the UK. I used the wrong adapter and I smelled smoke and it was too late.
Wow. So those are like basically really good lessons though to learn straight out of the gate.
Yeah, definitely were.
Hey, I want to talk about some of the artists you've worked with, and if you could talk maybe how you got the gig and if there was a cool or interesting story, and then if there was any takeaways or any things you learned that were like important that you filed away there. Let's start with Macy Gray.
Macy. I think you got my buddy Lamont. He's a drummer. He was playing with her at the time. And so he's like, yeah, Angie, I'll get you on this gig. And I'm like, all right, cool. And it was with Macy. I can't remember. This was like maybe like 2009 or 10. And we just did some local stuff in L.A. I think it was Hotel Cafe. Yeah, we played at Hotel Cafe in Los Angeles. And we would rehearse at her house, which is pretty funny. You know, she'd lay on her couch. We'd have all the equipment in the living room. kids would come home from school. So that was, I remember a funny instance where she needed, they were making French fries for the kids. And they don't like frozen French fries. I remember she goes, do you know how to cut up potatoes? Like, yeah. So, yeah, that was pretty cool. But she's just, yeah, she had cool energy. Music was fun and the band was great at the time. I think it was Justin Meldahl Johnson, great bassist. I think he produced some Paramore albums and worked with Nine Inch Nails. And, you know, this guy, Jeremy Rezumna, plays with Fits in the Tantrums, but he was with Macy at the time.
Yeah.
And so it was just a really cool band. And these are guys I've always looked up to, and just to be able to be in the same room with all of them. I'm like, damn, this is cool.
That is cool.
And her stuff is quirky and funky, and that's what kind of like the stuff I like. So, yeah, I mean, it was a short-lived gig, but it was definitely an experience to have, and I'm, you know, grateful for it.
How about CeeLo Green?
And CeeLo, well, I was subbing for someone at the time. It happened last year. Again, at the time, I'm living in Milwaukee, but, you know, I was like, hey, that's worth coming. I came out to L.A. for that one. And was it L.A.? We rehearsed, I think maybe, oh no, we rehearsed in Florida. So it was just word of mouth that came from, hey, I can't do this gig, but I know this girl, Angie, that can do it. And so, you know, he's a character too. He's a lot of fun. It's an all female group. Again, killing players that can really make or break a gig. When you love who you play with, yeah. If you love the musicianship, it makes it just so much fun. And it's just a really cool vibe. And again, just super funky stuff, really stylish, like Low, that's what we call him. His fiance is also the stylist of the group. So, you know, he's really into the visuals. And yeah, it was just a really cool experience just to get that. That was my first time in South America. I'm going to be forgetting things now.
Oh, it gets worse.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Geez, I'm gonna have to go through my passports now. I'm on my third passport. It's pretty nuts.
Wow, that is awesome.
But this third one now, I have to get like the extra thicker pages because I just don't, you know, just so I don't have to deal with it for a while.
How long was the CeeLo gig?
The CeeLo gig, this was another one-off. Like I do a lot of spot dates with artists because they weren't going on full tours. But then once you're in their database, it's really cool because, you know, they'll be like, all right, yeah, let's use this person. Let's use that person. It's kind of funny because I'm noticing a lot more female, and this is a great thing, a lot more female guitarists and players in general are getting opportunities, and not just with all female groups. They're not thinking about the gender anymore. It's just like, all right, I want a guitar player.
Right.
And it's not just, when you hear the word guitar player, you think of five guys. Now you hear a word guitar player and you think of five people,
yeah.
Versus people, I hate when people go, you're good, dot, 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 for a girl. I think that's the biggest fucking insult, because you can't be good for a guy. That's kind of how it's coming across. And so I correct people when I hear that, because, you know, there's still a lot of issues in the industry, but we can delve on in a whole nother episode. But
that's funny. No, you're good, dot, 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 for a girl.
Yeah, no, I get that. Yeah, I've heard that a lot. Or or people will assume, they go, what do? Comma, sing, question mark. I flipped that once. I said to a guy, what do? Do you play jaw harp? Yeah. It's just that assumption. But yeah, back to the CeeLo thing. I'm sorry. I go.
No, no, it's cool. This is all like relevant shit that goes through people's heads. So it's relevant to this conversation. Totally.
Okay. Yeah. But I mean, like the CeeLo thing, another, like, it was short, but sweet. Kind of like he is, but yeah, no, it's really good. And, you know, they've kept in touch. And actually, while I was on the road with David, the hotel we're staying at, CeeLo and his fiance and some friends just happened to be in the lobby of the hotel, and I ran into them, and I'm just like, oh, whoa, hey, I'm here with David. And then they all sat down, and we all just kind of talked and caught up. So
that's really cool. But yeah, plus, not for nothing, but when a guy who hired you sees you now in traffic with another like major artist, that increases your marketability, your positioning, like it's not like, oh, I can call Angie. She's sitting around.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, she's,
well, what's awesome about that, like, I've grown a relationship with David over the months, and, you know, I consider him a friend, and I just see him as a person, as a guy who's really funny. He's brilliant, great to work with, very caring, and just very considerate of everyone. But then I forget, this guy's a fucking legend.
Yeah.
And so I'm playing with this guy, and people that I admire are admiring the show. And so they're coming to us like, oh, I love the show. I love the show. I'm like, I love you. Like the Franz Ferdinand guys, they're awesome. Sarah McLachlan, who I was huge on with she did Lilith Fair between 97 and 99. You know, she really inspired me as I was growing up and playing, and she came and saw one of our shows. And so I'm playing guitar thinking, oh my God, people I look up to are in the audience watching this right now. And that's all because of playing for such an icon.
Yeah. But that also is great for your career. I mean, let's face it, people are seeing you do and they're liking what you're doing. It's like, hey, now you're on the radar screen of all the people watching you, in addition to, and these people are all going to be looking for guitar players at some point.
Oh yeah. I mean, I hope so, because I'm looking for a job.
Well, no, that's how it works, Angie. People, you know, heard.
Well, again, that's the network. I'm talking, this is a network thing. So.
Yeah. That's great. That's really
cool. It's funny because once you're on the road with someone like that, or just on a tour that runs for a long time, it's kind of like out of sight, out of mind, where people assume you're still on the road. So you have to make it very clear to people. Like, I left Cirque du Soleil 2 or 3 years ago, and maybe a month ago, somebody asked me if I was still with Cirque du Soleil.
so let me ask you this. Would this, because again, I've run a marketing company for 20 years, so this is how my brain thinks. Like, would it be inappropriate when you come back to town and you just send out an email to people, whether in a mass email or just group? Hey, you know, just, I had a really good time on the tour. Just wanted to share with you a couple of cool things that we did. So now people know, oh, you know, let me get her back on my radar.
Well, yeah. I mean, I kind of do that, reaching out to people throughout. Not so much email. I think that's a good idea, though, to do it more email, because a lot of people do social media, and that helps too. But yeah, I think email's a little bit more. I hate to even call it now. Email's considered personal versus
like a
group thing. It's so funny now. I mean, that's a great idea to do. And you know, like I said, after my month hiatus, I'm definitely going to reach out next. I mean, next month is NAMM, which is super cool for networking. I haven't been to NAMM for 2 years. I mean, last year I couldn't, because I was getting ready to move to New York to do rehearsals with David. So I think this year would be just great, just to kind of, you know, show face and say what's up to people.
Oh, and totally. I would send that email out and say, hey, by the way, I'll be at NAMM.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that would be a really good thing.
It's so crazy there, though. There was 1 year I had a pass and I didn't even go to NAMM. I just went to all the events outside, because I knew people were going to be in town. And sometimes all that fluorescent light, and every 5 seconds you're having the same conversation with somebody, and you're just like, hey man, good to see you. Yeah. Yeah. Let's catch up. Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And the next time you see them is at the next NAMM.
Yeah. Yeah.
unless you do like follow up emails. And, you know, like I said, with this past tour, I've kind of been more on the radar and people have been reaching out to me like, hey, you want to try this product or whatever. But
that's great. That's really good. That's awesome.
Yeah. But
do you want to talk about your EP a little bit? I know you've been working on that now. I know this is your off month, but talk a little bit about it because I'm interested on but people will be interested.
Well, yeah. Well, I started working on it maybe like 5 years ago, maybe longer than that. It's definitely a work in progress. I've had to put it on the back burner a couple times when gigs come up. I think I was living in Los Angeles when it first started. And then I did the 3-year tour with Cirque du Soleil. So I was never in one place long enough. But what I did while I was traveling was I'd find a local studio. If there was a musician I liked there, I'd record them. For instance, Thomas Pridgen, who played with Mars Volta, he's a great drummer, amazing drummer. I love guitar. I play it, but drums is up there with one of my favorite instruments. Yeah. I don't know why. I've always just been very rhythmic, and you can hear that in my playing. I'm a big rhythm player. So I had Thomas record with me, like Ron Bruner, another amazing drummer. So I've got these hard drives full of material and I just need to put it all together, get my guitar work on there. And so this EP has been like a collaboration of myself and a lot of different colleagues that I really admire. And I just kind of want to get the finishing touches on that to get that out there, get it mixed, mastered. I have about 11 or 12 songs. I'm going to bring it down to two separate EPs, both with 5 songs. But before this year's over, I'd definitely like to at least get the single released, especially coming off this tour with the exposure I have right now.
Good for you. Well, I hope it works. And you come back on here, we could promote it and talk about it. That'd be great.
Cool.
You grew up in Milwaukee, right?
Yes.
What was your childhood like growing up?
It was cool. I mean, Milwaukee, you know, the city's had issues recently. And, you know, it's not the city I had seen when I grew up. I lived in a really diverse neighborhood. I went to like a global education elementary school. And then I was really into art and music, visual art, you know, painting. And, you know, my father is a not professional guitar player, but he played guitar and bass. And we had like a little setup in our basement. So he'd bring guys over and I'd smell those funny jazz cigarettes. I would always smell these cigarettes. I'm like, I don't know what, you know. And then when I got to college, I realized what kind of cigarettes they were. And
that's so funny. Is weed legal over there now?
It is now. Yes. But you know, this was the 80s. He didn't smoke, but his friends did, and I didn't know.
Oh, come on. That's what he told you.
Yeah, probably. And I'll just believe that. But no, he had this old 72 Strat, this old Stratocaster. And I used to try to pluck the strings. I think there's a video of me online somewhere playing ukulele at 3 years old or trying to. And I already had that right hand technique, that strumming down. So my mother's a big lover of music. She used to listen to Robert Cray, Bonnie Raitt. My dad got me in Stevie Ray Vaughan, which Stevie Ray, you know, his last concert was at Alpine Valley, Wisconsin. I wish I could find that ticket stub. I was 7 or 8 years old.
Oh, you were there?
Yes, but I don't remember it. I was too young.
Oh, wow.
But so it was so Stevie Ray Vaughan, Jimmy Vaughan, Robert Cray, Eric Clapton. And, you know, my dad was devastated. Yeah. And it was, you know, I just knew something had happened. Again, I was like 6 or 7 years old. I think it was 1990 or 89. And so, I watched his videos growing up and I was really inspired by him. Somebody who inspired me that people probably don't know much about, or they know him, but they wouldn't think from hearing me play that I even listened to this guy. Joe Satriani, Surfing with the Alien.
Great record.
That's my favorite album. Oh my God. Was it Always With You, Always With Me, Crushing Day? My dad used to play that cassette in his car and I just love that. I always would wear I'd wear my wigs, my long wig and mess around with a little plastic guitar. And I love that. I love Joe Satriani. And I always think that's funny when I tell people that because they're like, really? But
that was a great album. There's a lot of melodic stuff on there.
Oh, so yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, his guitar playing, it just sounded like a voice to me.
Yeah.
And it just always stuck with me. But all that sweeping stuff, I never really got too good at that. But, you know, back to the Stevie thing. So I just recently, I think I was in Austin, Texas, went to a place called Austin Vintage Guitars. We were playing ACL. I'm sitting there because I was doing a conversation with some people from Berkeley. Mm. A guy from Berkeley worked there, and I think I was doing an interview. And Jimmy Vaughn walked in.
Oh, cool.
And I don't, you can't, you know, in my studio here, I've got a, he wrote a note for me. We just started playing and talking, and he was telling me how he uses flat wound strings on his telly. And so he let me play it a bit. I'm like, oh, that's really interesting. He's like, yeah, feel my fingers. They're just so soft. Like, and he's like, yeah, you should try flat wounds. I'm like, oh, cool. Thanks. Well, yeah, nice to meet you. And he left. And then right before I left the store, they go, oh, Angie left. Jimmy left a message for you. He wrote a handwritten note. This is Angie. It was great meeting you. Try these out sometime. Love, Jimmy.
Man, how and cool is that?
He bought me a pack of the Diodario flatwounds.
That's so cool.
I just framed that. And, you know, I just picked up another guitar recently. So I'm thinking I might put those on that guitar. Try it out. So
that's really cool. That's a nice story.
Yeah.
What kind of work did your folks do when you were younger?
My mother, she worked at City Hall in Milwaukee for about 35 years.
Wow, that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah, I know. She's got a great retirement plan that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
For several years now. And my father worked as he was an engineer at a factory here. I think the factory closed down a while back, but, you know, they both are in their retirement years, so.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So you started, like, digging on your dad's guitars, and it went from there?
Yeah, just kind of playing around with it. I think my first instruments were a clarinet and piano, but I just never practiced. And I could, you know, my mother would say she could tell I didn't have interest in it. So, you know, I got into guitar. I got my first guitar, I think, in 1993, like my first real guitar, which was actually a Harmony from a JCPenney catalog. It was probably like 60 bucks.
I love those Stratatones. Those are great. Those are so cool.
And I still have it, but it's like covered with stickers and just broken up now. But I still have that guitar somewhere in my mother's house.
That's nice.
So I started taking lessons with this guy named Norm Kaminsky in a southern part of Milwaukee. So old Polish guy. And he would just, you know, I'm seeing these videos. At the time I wanted to play like Joe Satriani. But I'm going to this guy who's like in a polka band. And he like just, you know, does chords. And I'm like, why is he teaching all these damn chords? I want to rip, you know. But actually, I'm going to tell you a quick story. You know, guys are ripping and showing all that fancy stuff. And then my teacher wants to do rhythm. This is something someone told me a month ago. They said, your right hand gets you paid and your left hand gets you laid.
Man, that is like really probably very accurate.
Because they're like, you know, the general audience wants to see all that rippy, all that fancy stuff. But if you can just stay in the pocket and play your part, that's what will get you the job. And so now I think about that, because that's what Norm was probably teaching me. He wouldn't have said that to me, you know. I would hope not. So he really got me into rhythm chords, rhythm slashes, you know, and then that really helped with my comping at a very young age, 12, 13, you know, learning scales, pentatonic. And I went to guitar camps in Green Bay, Wisconsin every summer. Again, I was in music school or art schools, and they had music classes. So that's kind of how I started, just studying in school and outside of school, just nonstop music. I went to the Wisconsin Conservatory of Music, and you know, that's kind of where I got into jazz. My mother listened to a lot of old jazz records. So she loved Take Five by Dave Brubeck.
Great. I love that.
Odd Time Signatures, 5/4, again, with that comping stuff. I'm like, it just always resonated with me. And, you know, all that comping and learning these chords and these different inversions at a young age helped me to get a scholarship to Berkeley, because a lot of people coming to Berkeley were just, you know, doing blues, ripping, which is great.
The shredding,
Yeah, the shredding stuff. But then and you can like comp and, you know, and read too. You know, I was reading pretty well at that time. But, you know, I became more of an ear player once I got to Berkeley, going to jam sessions. And because, you know, I was always looking for charts, and I was always intimidated with all these people who could play without a chart in front of them. And I'm like, shit, I'm going to do that. I'm going to start playing more by ear. So I think it's a balance of being able to play by ear and reading, because you come to a lot of situations and there may not be charts. So,
and you come across as like somebody who's always had a fair amount of, if not confidence, but belief in yourself.
Oh, no, no, I was no, I got picked on a lot. It was kind of hard growing up, but even though I remember I was class president in high school or vice president, and I still got stuffed in lockers. You know, I never
really
goofy stuff. Yeah. I mean, school was very cliquey growing up, and I just never felt like I belonged in any specific group, which felt like, it felt really shitty in high school, because you want to feel like, and middle school, that was treacherous, but you want to feel like you belong somewhere. And I didn't, you know, I felt like I skimmed the edges of each group of people. You know, I was on a golf team in high school because we went to art school. You choose between swim and golf. And I played golf. You know, my dad used to play a little bit of golf, so they called me Tigress Woods. I did music, golf, and then, you know, I was into art and
Tigress Woods. That's hilarious.
Yeah. So, but like I said, I never had a click. I was just kind of moved around to different people, which was cool. That's how I still feel like I am now. I don't run in big circles. So,
yeah. But you know, you read all these things. I've read a lot of things about over the years about how high school is the best years of your life. And honestly, I think there are people out there who might have experienced that, but I don't know anybody.
I don't know what book you're reading.
That's what they've told my generation through, you know, our whole in, you know, media was, you know, oh, those are the best years of your life. And that being said, I know nobody who like really felt good about themselves and their position. I think everybody I knew felt like an outsider and not really belonging anywhere. So it was really weird that I always used to read this stuff. I was like, okay.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, I've heard that about college. You know, that's like the time of self-discovery, because for, you know, middle school, high school, you're still living under somebody's roof. You're being told what to do and what blueprint to follow. And, you know, when I was growing up, I was like, all right, I'm going to go to high school, go to college, be married by 23, have kids by 24. This whole blueprint of life. That doesn't work. By the time I was 23 and 24, I was like, no, I'm not ready for any of that. Some of my schoolmates had kids that early, and you know, they love their kids, but they're like, no, go live your life.
Yeah, that's good advice.
Yeah, you know, you follow your own path. You can't, you know, you're taught things, but then you got to use your other years to unlearn some of that stuff and learn for yourself.
I agree with you.
So, like, for me, college was a time of discovery, because, you know, you were forced to, you know, make your own decisions and become responsible. Like, are you going to do this now? Are you going to go out? And so I liked having that freedom of leaving home and being able to move to another city and discover myself, where, you know, some people like to go to school close to home. You know, I was in Boston. My family's in Milwaukee. So, yeah, I kind of branched out a little bit.
And you handled it well. It sounds like you didn't get out of control or anything.
I absolutely did. Yeah. And I'm glad like a lot of those tapes were destroyed. But I went to Berkeley I was in college at a very pivotal moment. I auditioned for Berkeley on a cassette tape. Okay. When I got into school, I was recording my school projects on a mini disc player. Okay. By the time I got out of school in 2005, everything was becoming digital. Like, this is around time Napster. So I had to adjust to all of that. Again, I started with a cassette tape, and things were digital by the time I was out. So it was a very pivotal moment with technology just changing so rapidly and having to keep up with that kind of stuff. So by the time I left Berkeley, I was like, did I learn everything I was supposed to and how I was supposed to? I mean, even now you go back and, you know, now they have like turntables is an instrument you can audition on.
Wow.
That would have been unheard of. Well, you can play a scale. My brother's a DJ out in New York, and you can play a scale on a record. I don't know how, but I've heard it done.
That's it. Wow.
So I'm sorry. I go on tangents, but I just like to talk.
No. It's cool. Definitely do not apologize. This is all interesting stuff. The only time it's bad is if when someone goes on a tangent, and it's like boring.
Well, but, see, I'm from the Midwest. We apologize a lot, so I'm sorry for apologizing.
All good. Did you like, what were some of the bigger surprises for you from the business end of things? So whenever those surprises first hit you, could have been when you did your first tour of the UK with the Brooklyn band. It could have been this tour with David. What were some of the surprises that you've seen, or that were like, holy crap, I didn't know that, or God, that sucks, or that's interesting.
Well, there's a lot of all of that. Well, you know, learning about joining the union, you know, and realizing some gigs are unionized and some aren't, like health insurance, and learning how to do 1099s and W-2s. Just, again, a lot of this stuff just kind of hits you all at once. And, you know, learning the financial part. And, you know, at the end of the year, if you're doing a bunch of 1099 and freelance stuff, it can be very overwhelming, and you can get like fall behind or get really messed up in that, in your finances. And there's a lot of stuff you don't, there's no blueprint. You're not going to be told about it. You just kind of discover it along the way. So that was a big surprise to me. You know, also, you know, even I'm speaking as a Black female, the industry is very hard, and people, you know, well, a lot of people, they audition with their eyes.
And they listen to music with their eyes.
They listen with their eyes. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, sometimes a little disheartening where you wouldn't even be considered for a gig because of what you looked like. And, you know, in other industries, you're like, you can't do that. That's discrimination. But, you know, in our entertainment industry, it's kind of, you know, it's a little bit different. So, you know, my perspective I found is a little different with considering who I am and my background versus a lot of my colleagues, because it is a male dominated industry. It is a white male dominated industry. So, you know, being able to navigate in such ways. But again, you know, it's a matter of surrounding yourself by good and real people. And like any industry, you adapt to it, but you also have to really know yourself coming into this industry and be confident in that. And, you know, don't make compromises that you're uncomfortable with. So,
is there a way like you can vet like some of these auditions? Like, can you almost say, hey, you know, I'm a Black female coming? I mean, it's so that you're not, like, so you're not wasting your time and you know, your energy and all that stuff. Is
well. Not really a way to vet. I mean, people usually know what they're looking for. There was this one artist, I won't say her name, but I remember I didn't audition for her, but I had heard about it. And they said specifically she's looking for white guys above 6'1" with beards. I was like, well, give me some baby powder and some stilts and a beard mask.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
No, but wow. No. So it's crazy. Like some of the, and it's not, you know, again, it's the people who mostly, they usually don't even know about music. It's the management, the people up top that ask for these crazy things. So I think that's really, really funny. I mean, the industry, again, it's changing. It's becoming more open to a lot of people. I'm seeing so many more diverse situations, and not saying a band should be put together because it's diverse, but I just think that the opportunities should be available to everyone at all times.
Sure. I totally,
because you never know the different ingredients. You know, that's when you're putting a band together, I think you're trying to find the right ingredients, and also, you know, things that work on and off stage. Yeah, so again, that's why the good attitude, no matter who you are, no matter where you come from, when you're in a work setting, I think just having a good attitude, again, not being an asshole, is the most important thing.
You know, it's interesting. I've talked to guys in Nashville, and I was talking to a guy, he's probably in his mid-60s, and he's a very successful session player, and he gets hired on a gig, and, you know, they knew who he was before he got hired. 2 weeks out on the gig, they said, you know, you got to leave, you're too old.
That's another thing, age.
And he was that's why I said to you, can you vet? Because like, they knew who he didn't like get old in 2 weeks.
I mean, they have to be forthcoming in the beginning, I think.
Yeah.
This is what we're looking for. But again, that's ageism in a way. I mean, it's again, it depends on the vibe. If you've been on the road, I think, you know, I experienced that a little bit with Fifth Harmony, where I realized I was 12 to 14 years older than everybody else in the band. And once they called me grandma, and I was like, oh, shit, what's this? Again, I'm 36. I can't remember who didn't. So, but yeah, I was like, damn, am I really that old? Because I don't feel that way. But I think it's just a vibe thing, you know. I mean, everybody was great. But you put a bunch of people in a group. And, you know, everything can be cool. But I guess, again, it's just an energy thing.
Yeah.
You know, the pace they're going at. And you know, some tours, on another hand, some tours, they like to, some people just like to, they think touring is like party and fun. And, you know, it's, especially non-musicians, they think it's sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I'm like, no, it's early lobby calls, back pain.
Yeah.
And, you know, you really got to stay focused and keep your head strong in there. Cause, and so, yeah, I don't know in that instance you're telling me about, but again, yeah, people need to be very straightforward with what they're looking for in the first place. And I think that would really help and, you know, smooth things out. So, yeah.
You know, that being said, you've worked with some major artists. So at the same time, you can say, you know, you've got something that works, period.
You know, and one thing about that is definitely, I mean, I'm very grateful and happy that I've had the opportunity to work with so many different great people. Definitely worked my ass off to get to that place. Right. But it's also very important to stay humble.
Yeah.
To stay humble and to keep your ego in check, because things can go as quickly as they arrive. It's like, you know, you may have worked with people, but you want to keep a good rapport with people. And you can say, oh, yeah, I worked with this person, but they were an asshole. They weren't fun to work with. They weren't a pleasure to work with. And, you know, today, just from this tour, our production manager came, dropped off my gear today, and he just thanked me. He said, thank you for always being professional, which means always being on time. Yeah. When I say on time, that means 15 minutes early, because when you're on time, you're late. Like if they say start at 5, be there at 4:30, 4:45 for a 5 o'clock downbeat.
Mm.
So just, you know, showing that kind of professionalism and care, you show that you care about the project you're on. And that, I think that's really important. And so no matter what color you are, whatever, your work ethic definitely should reflect on that. And I would hope that my resume is enough to make people think, okay, yeah, well, we should value this person and not undercut them or lowball them, because, you know, sometimes that does happen a lot. And, you know, I've been on gigs before where you have to chase the money afterwards, or these people want to use you, and then they boast about you on stage. That happened to me before. I played with an artist. They're like, check out my female guitar. Like the show's not about me.
It's
about the person I'm playing for. And they're like, check out this girl guitar player. She's played with da 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 da, and listed off. And I'm like, don't ever.
Yeah, that's not cool.
It's so tacky, man. I hate that shit.
Yeah, that is tacky. But you mentioned work ethic. I was going to say your work ethic is, you're not fucking around. You know, you're going to tell you have a really good work ethic, and that comes loud and clear.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I love to relax. I mean, I'll be honest. If I stand up here, I am wearing a Cookie Monster onesie.
There you go.
It's actually pretty goofy.
But, no, it's all no. But I mean, your work, you could just tell. I mean, you're a hustler. And I mean that in a like totally good, a very admirable way. I like people like that work hard. I always say on the show, I think that, you know, someone's work ethic is a good indication of who they are with respect to everything in their life, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely worth it. I mean, I'd rather work hard now so I don't have to work hard later in the day, you know, later in my life. So,
Let's talk about some gear for a few minutes. What's your go-to? I mean, I know you got a bunch of new guitars. You just showed me. What's your go-to guitar right now? And what other guitars would round out your top three? But the stuff you want to go to, not like things that you have to go to for a session or something.
Well, I've been playing on that Nags Kanai guitar, which is pretty nice. Got a really nice thick neck that I like. I like the thinner necks too, depending on the style I'm playing. While I was on the road, I think it was in Austin Vintage Guitars, I picked up, what is this? This little like a Dan Electro. which is kind of just a little thing. I always wanted this when I was like 14, 15 years old, and it plays really well. So
that's amazing. Yeah. You like thick neck guitars and you're a, you know, small frame person.
Yeah,
but well, you have, you know what? You have long fingers.
That was nice. I've got here. I'll show you. I'll put a dollar up.
That's all. I wish I had your fingers. Holy smokes,
well,
man.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing. I used to get, when I said I got picked on as a kid, you know, skinny legs, big feet, big hands. So it was like shaped L, like an L shape, the feet and the legs. And so I thought that stood for Les Paul. So I ended up, so I have these huge hands, and I'm like, well, what the hell am I going to do with them? And I saw Jimi Hendrix had big hands. And so it's really good for playing guitar. Even though, like, God, people like what Van Halen has, like, tiny hands, you know, but he's a ripper. But, you know, I used to play a little piano too. I still do. And so now nobody says, God, you have, your hands are weird. Now they're valuable.
Oh yeah. So is that Dan Electro, like, your one of your top three, or?
No, I wouldn't even say that's my top three. Oh, and I have another one that a buddy of mine made. It's called a Rickencaster. Definitely this, I would say this Nags, the Kanai, and my Novo. And then reach here. It's actually pretty heavy. This is called a Rickencaster.
So that looks like a Tele, a thin line Tele with a Bigsby, two humbuckers.
Yeah, F-hole. And then my friend Rick Torres actually, well, he just like put a bunch of pieces together, assembled this. It was like $130, but it sounds great. I did all these smooth jazz tours with this, and it's called a Rickencaster.
So that's in one of your top three then?
Yeah, I'd say so. And you know what's crazy? I never take it on the road anymore. I used it last with Cirque du Soleil. And then I used it a lot again with smooth jazz, I think. Yeah, George Benson touched this guitar. Yeah, he played. He's like, that's an interesting guitar. It was like for like a smooth jazz festival.
That's wild.
Yeah.
And you paid $130, you said?
Yeah.
That's nuts.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. So, yeah, it's funny what you can get.
So your Rickencaster, your Nags, the two Nags, what else would be
and
up there?
And then this Novo, the Novo Cirrus, that this guitar feels great. It's got the sustain. I played a note on here about 2 days ago, and I think I still hear it ringing.
Novo, where are they out of?
Novo, those are guys in Nashville. Yeah, they're the guys in Nashville. That's Dennis Fano's thing. Dennis Fano.
Oh, okay.
But this Nags here is definitely my number one. I've been playing it the most. It's the one I played with. I played with so many people. I played with CeeLo, played with Fifth Harmony in Asia. And I played this with David as well. This is the Kanai with the two humbuckers, the like, Seth Lovers.
Very cool.
I sold my amp though. That's in the, I'm in the market now for a new amp. I had a Twin Reverb.
I got too a much Dr. weight. Z.
I've been looking at maybe the like Supro. Mm. I like Dr. Z amps. Car is good as well.
So. Yeah.
That's kind of my like post-tour gift to myself. It's like, all right, I'm going to go do a little bit of amp shopping. And I think like Chicago Music Exchange is a great store. So if I have a day to go down to Chicago and just like sit around and mess with some stuff. I like to bring my own guitar though to, you know, play through it.
There's a store, I think it's in the Midwest, Humbucker Music.
Okay, I haven't heard of that.
They're like the biggest Dr. Z dealer. They got nothing but amps, but you got to call. I don't know where, they may be too far for you, but I know they're in the Midwest. I think they're in the Midwest.
I'm writing it down.
Yeah, and also you got to call though, because they're a big online business, but I don't know how, you got to call to get, to come in their warehouse or their shop and see their, and play stuff, because I think they're mostly online. Humbucker Music. Yeah, and they have like a 50s style, you know, logo with the guy with the suit and tie or something like that. Yeah, okay. But I would check them out. They got tons of amps there. Tons. I think they're the largest Dr. Z dealer.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I'll have to figure out where they're at. That'd be cool.
You mentioned a couple of people that have influenced you. Like you said, Joe Satriani. Who else has maybe influenced you that people would be surprised to hear?
Oh, well, this isn't a surprise. And I can't believe I haven't mentioned him yet. Prince.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, people say I look like him. They're like, you play like him. And when I was with Cirque du Soleil, that's the first thing they said when I moved to Montreal. They're like, you remind us of Prince. And they threw me in this crazy, like, purple velvet cape and all this. Yeah, you know, at the time, I had a purple Les Paul.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I used to have a lot of Gibsons. I don't know what happened. I think I have one. They're in storage in L.A. I got to get some of those. But, Yeah, Prince. I've always, like, a lot of people don't realize how much of an amazing guitar player he is, because he's a great songwriter and he plays every instrument, but he can rip.
Yeah, for sure.
He's a great player. He's funky, and I love that stuff. Hendrix, like Robert Johnson, Django Reinhardt.
Do you play a lot of that stuff?
I don't do a lot of gypsy jazz. I used to when I was growing up. I think we did, like, minor swing and a couple different things, but the comping is really that stuff is so cool to me. And you know, like I said earlier on, I love the drums. I program drums. I don't play drums. For some reason, I can't get that hand foot coordination going. But when I play guitar, specifically rhythm, I'm always listening to the snare and the hi-hat and matching up with that to get in the pocket, listening to the different rhythms, polyrhythms the drummer's doing, and I'll match up with either him or her. And that's kind of,
you ever hear of a guy named Charlie Hunter?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. He's really good with, you know, he's a great guy for, you know, like rhythm and stuff like that. Just getting in the pocket. And he's a very percussive player.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, Desert Island Discs, top three, just for now, knowing they could change tomorrow.
Okay. Oh, that's a big one. I've been waiting for that one. But I wasn't prepared at all. But I would say Purple Rain, Physical Graffiti, and Don't Laugh at Me. No, it's nothing to laugh about. Sarah McLachlan Surfacing, because she has such a beautiful voice.
Oh, her voice. Yeah.
It's so angelic. Building a Mystery. Yeah. I don't know. Again, that one that came out in 96, 97. That's when I started transcribing songs when I was like 14, 15. Yeah, I'd been transcribing jazz stuff because, you know, if you could sing it, you can play it.
Yeah.
But then, like, her finger picking style and just how simple her band, her arrangements. I think Pierre Marchand or some guy from French Canadian, but he lives in Vancouver. And just to have a band of like 9 people and sound like 4 people. And I thought that was so cool. And so, yeah, I'd say definitely Sarah McLachlan, Led Zeppelin, and Prince.
Her voice is really beautiful. Very touching. Well, you know, she's the voice of that. There's a big ASPCA.
Oh, help my animals or something.
Yeah, right. You know, right. Yeah. And she's got that voice, and it's like, you know, the commercial comes on and you see these animals in cages and you're like crying.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
I would say it's very effective for that thing. But yeah,
I looked under my couch. I thought there was an onion. but then like Zeppelin, Physical Graffiti is, I love Page's playing. I love, like, In My Time of Dying.
Great song, man.
That's a, man, that song gets me all the time. I like put that on vinyl and pour my glass of scotch or have my chamomile tea with Sarah.
You have chamomile tea with Sarah and scotch with Page. That's funny.
Yeah. But, actually, what city was it in? Louisville, Kentucky. We played at the Bourbon and Beyond Festival with David this past year. And it got rained out the second day. We played the first day. Side stage watching us, I looked. It was like John Mayer, Lenny Kravitz, Sheryl Crow, and Robert Plant.
Holy shit. Did they come up and play at all?
No. We were doing our show with David. Our show is like completely choreographed. There's no instruments on stage. So like every song we're dancing and moving. The drummers all wear harnesses, the 6 drummers.
And there's like a separate, there's not a drum set. I heard this. Like,
no, there's no drum set. I don't know if you've seen any videos. They're all over YouTube, but we're fully dancing and playing. But, you know, they're all on the side stage watching us, which kind of sucked because we're all in in-ears, so you can't hear what's going on stage. All they were probably hearing was like drums. But just knowing those people were standing on the side of the stage watching was just like, oh my God. Because I'm a huge Zeppelin fan, so that was pretty amazing for me.
Man, that's so great for your career too. Honestly, I mean, and I'm sure that wasn't the only place you had people at that level checking you out. That's great. That's a really good thing that comes out of playing on a gig like that with a guy who's so iconic, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad I didn't see all of them because I saw Robert Plant, but then when we get off the stage, I think our sound guy, the monitors guy, was like, yeah, all these people, just list off these people who are like kind of peeking at us. And I'm like, oh shit. I'm so glad I didn't know that.
I would guarantee you from that tour, one of those people that peeked on you over that 11th month tour is going to call you for something.
Hey, I'm out there.
I would be shocked.
AngieSwan.com/connect.
There you go. AngieSwan.com/connect. What's some, you're so young. This is maybe too early to ask this question. I say young relative to me. Like I got kids who are just like a little younger than you. And you're young in general, but I don't want to mix. It's always so hard. I want to say the right thing and not say the wrong thing. But I mean it all complimentary. So most important things you've learned about yourself so far through your career experience and through life.
Yeah, that's a tough question. Wow. The most important thing I've learned about myself. I've learned that I'm resilient. I've kind of surprised myself in that way. There were so many times I felt like giving up and it's not all like parades and candy and all great stuff. I mean, as many tours and gigs as I've gotten, I haven't gotten like about 10 times that. So I've been told no a lot of times, or you shouldn't, or you can't. And, you know, like in the beginning of my career, you know, when work was like really slow and I was just struggling and just picking up whatever side jobs I could do. I was working at a temp agency in LA answering phones or telemarketing. And then at that point, you know, parents are like, are you sure this is what you want to do? Maybe you should find some other job. Like after Cirque du Soleil, it was pretty tough. I was working like for like $9 an hour back in Wisconsin. This is like 3 years ago, two years ago. Like just working wherever I could. But I also worked at a jazz club. I was doing like front of house sound, which was good just to stay kind of in that realm of music. So, you know, sometimes I felt like giving up. I was like, man, what am I doing? I'm like back at square one and back home and no work's coming in. Nothing's happening. It was kind of becoming depressed. And, you know, somehow like things kind of came together. And again, it's just, you know, believing in yourself and like keep pushing, keep going. And, you know, there are no such things as mistakes. They're just mistakes and you can do it again.
Yeah.
So I always would say, actually, I'm not a very religious person, but I used to play at a church in LA. And yeah, I was always tired or whatever. But there's one thing that preacher said. He said, a setback is nothing more than a setup for a comeback.
It sounds like something Muhammad Ali would have said or something like that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And so that you know, that always stuck in my head. And it's true. And so, you know, it gave me, you know, just getting a gig like this definitely gave me the confidence to keep pushing forward. And to prove, like a lot of people, when I left LA and moved back to Wisconsin, people are like, oh, so you're giving up? I'm like, I'm not giving up. I'm just moving somewhere else. They think you have to live in a major city to make things happen. But the way technology is now.
It's not true. No.
No, no. And I wasn't going to go back to LA and struggle to pay rent each month when I can get something three times the size for half the price.
Good for you.
And so that's kind of where I'm at now. So again, that's something I learned about myself. And I surprised myself with being as resilient as I didn't know I could be.
Good for you. And I really appreciate you being so honest as far as saying I've failed 10 times more than I've succeeded. I've been working for myself for 20 years, and I can tell you right now, every one of my buddies that works for themselves has had the same, myself and all of them have had the same experience. You know, you get a lot more failures than successes, you know, but the good thing is you don't need that many successes to get where you want to go. You know, usually when they hit, it hits pretty good, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I'm just kind of, you know, like I said, resting now, but always when I say resting, just working out my own stuff.
You're funny. It's okay. You can rest. It is okay.
No. Yeah. Well, yeah, no, this is rest for me. It's just relaxing because I'm not on anyone's schedule right now. You know, I've been catching up on emails and stuff, but I told people, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to take time for myself.
Good for you.
Yeah, I've been on, you know, some people can't fathom that because they haven't traveled for that long. Like,
no, it's well earned.
The day I came back from Australia, someone's like, yeah, come to my show tonight. I'm like, I literally feel like it's 2 days from now. Right? My brain is so off right now. And I said, I'll see you guys at the end of the month, but I'm just doing what I want to do. There's a lot of power in the word no. I used to say yes to things I didn't want to do because I felt bad if I didn't do it.
Yeah.
But I'd feel worse wasting my time and wasting that other person's time because it would be obvious that I wasn't interested.
Yeah. Hey, remember that if you ever have children, there's a lot of power in the word no.
Oh, yeah. No, that's true.
You got to be able to say no.
They would probably say, no, there isn't.
Hey, are you a rule breaker or a rule follower?
A little bit of both. I mean, I will follow the rules as long as it's within my comfort zone. And if something feels off, I'll speak up about it.
Good for you. Best childhood memory?
Oh, there's so many. I don't know. There's ons and offs. I could think of the funniest. I don't know. I think I said something funny once, made my brother piss himself, but I don't know.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah. I would say maybe one of my old elementary school teachers, or my mother showed me this video of me in elementary school. Again, I went to public schools in Milwaukee, and I went to a school called Lloyd Street Elementary School. And they called it a global education school. So even at a very young age, I was learning about the world. Actually, this right here, it sits on my desk. It's a globe from my fifth grade graduation. I got this 24 years ago. And I used to look at it and point to places I wanted to go. And I've been pretty much everywhere now, which is pretty awesome. I just found this globe. It used to be clear, but now it's kind of yellow. It's faded over time.
I keep
this globe right on my little studio monitor right here. And so I remember just getting together with all these different kids, and we'd have all these like world events, like little play things, potluck dinners. And I think it's a faded memory, but I look at videos and I kind of recall it. And I think that.
So that was a good really, experience for you that.
At 9, 10, 11 years old, it really helped form my dreams of what I wanted to do and where I wanted to go. Like looking at these places on this globe, thinking, wow, that exists. All this water, there's other places besides where I am right now. And so I think that was a good memory.
That's really cool. Any hobbies or interests outside of music?
Yeah, sleep and cooking. Yeah. I mean, that's one thing. Oh my God. I cook so much food. I'm really, I'm a huge fan of Anthony Bourdain, RIP. Mm-hmm. I'm very into trying different things. I ate a duck's head in Shenzhen, China.
How was
I'm
that?
Not even, it was horrible, but I tried it. I mean, a couple weeks ago, I had a kangaroo steak on top of blood sausage.
Oh my God.
It was delicious. Oh my God. You have it rare because it's so gamey. It has to be tender. But then, today's my vegan day, so I switch it up. When I was in India for about a month and a half, I ate vegetarian that whole time. Cooking, I pick up different oils and spices, and everywhere I travel and I come home and try to cook.
That's cool.
But I'm so rusty with cooking now. I haven't cooked in 10 months, and I burnt this pizza, and it looked like brownies when it came out. I'm like, I can't even warm up pizza right now. What am I going to do?
Yeah, you'll be fine. It's like
so I
got to
slowly but surely get back into cooking.
Hey, did you happen to realize this when you were in India? Like, I've interviewed some really cool blues cats. There's some great blues players in India.
I heard about that. That's kind of, I went out there playing blues and rock. I was like teaching, doing clinics at schools for like young kids around like the middle school, elementary school ages. I think that's more up north in Bombay.
Yes, that's exactly
Bombay,
where it is.
Mumbai.
Mumbai, yeah.
Yeah, I was more in the southern part of India, like Kochi, Chennai, Bangalore. It's like from southwest to southeast. But it was around, I think, November, December 2015. And this is kind of what brought me back to Wisconsin. This was between Cirque du Soleil and coming back home. I got stuck in the largest monsoon they'd had in 100 years.
Oh my God.
And I documented it and put it on YouTube. It's called Angie Swan's India Adventure. It's about a 20-minute video. and I got stranded at an airport, and I had to call the U.S. embassy. The airport flooded out. I was 4 days sleeping on a floor in an airport. I'm sorry, 3 days sleeping on a floor in an airport, not knowing if I was going to get home. I had to call the U.S. embassy, but then they flooded out, so they closed down. I had just a little juice on my phone to call my mother, tell her I was alive and okay.
I was going to say, your parents must have been freaking out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was horrible. It was a huge storm. And then people were like fighting over buses to get through, to drive 13 hours to the next city to get out and fly. And so that whole video, I documented it.
Angie Swan's India adventure. Holy crap.
Yeah. I remember I had my guitar with me. It was a guitar and a bag and my friend Jean from France. So just the two of us stuck in this airport with like 400 other people. And it was crazy. I didn't know if I was going to get home. So after that, I said, all right, I need to get back to my family because that shit was scary.
Yeah. Holy crap. Two more questions. Toughest decision you've had to make or most difficult thing you've had to do so far?
I wouldn't say that. I don't know so far, but like I said, sometimes I was down on my luck. I had to sell guitars. That hurt. And I once sold a guitar to a buddy so I could buy it back from him eventually.
Sure.
But then I noticed he got attached to it, so I didn't want to buy it back. But I've had to pawn, I think, are any of these? No, none of these guitars, but other guitars I've had to pawn before when I was living in LA just to pay rent.
Wow.
And then I'd have to borrow guitars to play gigs. And I think I had this Mesa Boogie head. I had to pawn that just to eat. Again, it was tough enough. Yeah. It was very expensive and it was embarrassing, but a lot of people are going through it.
Yeah.
Talk about it. And it's important to talk about it because you need friends to support each other in your ups and downs. And so I remember having to sell these guitars and it's just such a painful feeling. I still think about it. I see pictures of these guitars. I'm like, damn, I miss it. I hope it's okay.
Yeah.
And I remember I sold this bass to this one person and they're like, oh, it just sits in the back of my closet. I'm like, ugh. But I think that was always hard for me having to do that. And now I've gotten to a point, I told myself I'll never do it again. Trial and error. I said, I never want to feel that feeling again. So I'm going to make sure that doesn't happen again.
Good for you.
So, letting go of your babies, that was kind of hard. Some of them I got back, other ones I didn't, but, in LA, they actually have pawn shops that were very catering to musicians. So they would help, they would help you out. They were very careful with the instruments. Like sometimes those guitars sat there for 6 months.
Right.
Yeah, so it was pretty crazy. And I'd have to pay to extend the contract. So I think that was the hardest decision I had to make.
I hope that's the toughest thing that ever happens to you. That would be great.
I don't know if it has been the toughest thing. I'd really have to think about that question.
No, I said I hope that is the toughest thing because that's a pretty good life because you're past that now. That's a situational thing. And I give you a lot of credit. Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, for now, I mean, there's always issues, whether it's health or family or just, preparing for the future. I'm still for me, I'm still paying off school. School is very expensive and, that's something, as an American, the cost of schooling
is crazy.
It's ridiculous. You spend your life paying it off and that's kind of like a burden on the shoulders that causes stress, especially again, you have these gigs, but they're not. I have, it's definitely a roller coaster. It's like the stock market, ups and downs. So as grateful as this year was, I can hope next year was great. The year before this year wasn't so good. So
yeah,
it's against that momentum and the whole planning thing.
I give you credit for having the awareness to say it's important that you share these things with friends because you need support.
Yeah.
I think that's a really, I think that's a very smart, I know for me, I never did that, to be honest with you. So yeah. I was always just my own issues, the way I was raised sort of, but I do that now and I realize how incredibly, and I've always been there to support my friends, but I just never, that wasn't my deal. Now I do, and life's a lot less stressful. That's why I really respect and admire you that, you know, you had that awareness.
Well, it's really, I mean, it's important to listen to people. And I mean, really listen to them, because especially in LA, people will tell you everything's great and they'll go home and cry. Because you really don't. And with social media and stuff, you know, people are so quick to judge by what they're seeing externally.
Yes.
They're judging the external by what they're feeling internally, and it's making them feel worse. Mm. And so that's why it's very important to have real connections with people and reach out, because you'll see me, I'm traveling and stuff, having fun, whatever. But at the end of the day, you don't know how I'm really feeling. Unless
of course.
You really, and a lot of people seem to forget that because of these social media things that make you, because you're only showing what you want people to see.
Of course. And then you got like I have these clients that, let's see how I could say this gently. That's another thing that's happened to me. I've gotten all gentle and shit. That are like Facebook relationships, you know, like they profess their undying love for one another. And I'm like, God, that's nothing like the conversations I hear when I'm talking to either one of y'all, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And you get these Facebook moms and it's like, holy shit, man. I mean, like, it's exactly what you're saying. It's just a Facebook.
Yeah.
It's a Facebook world, not the real world.
Well, you know, it's funny because I was very discouraged while living in LA when I was getting when I wasn't getting invitations to audition because they were looking for guys.
Yeah.
And so I had this thought, I'm like, maybe I should leave LA, get a sex change and come back and say, hi, my name's Matt. I play guitar. I really thought about this. I
totally get it.
I was going to make a website with just a random guy's picture, but have me playing and make a whole website, just make up a name.
Yeah.
And like put out a press kit.
Yeah.
I never did it, but I really thought about it.
I could totally understand it, because you're sitting there and you're like, this is absolute bullshit. And here's what I could do about it. But I totally understand that. And
well, I'll even go this, the pay scale. Women don't get paid the way guys do in the industry, in almost any industry. And that's another thing that, you know, I've dealt with, knowing your worth, you know, coming in, knowing something, like knowing how to negotiate. And, you know, I've done things before where I thought I had negotiated a good price to find out I'm making a quarter of what other people are making or a half. And, you know, so that's another issue. Like, there's so many issues in the industry, like I said, that I face that people kind of brush under the rug. But, you know, it's, all this stuff's kind of coming to the forefront slowly but surely. And I think that's important. Again, another something good to talk about and discuss, you know, amongst your peers and in general, musician unions need to be stronger, because a lot of people get lowballed now, which is bullshit. Guys and girls are getting lowballed left and right, where money's going into the pocket of a label or something. And, you know, again, like the industry has just changed so much since, you know, like say 2001 when I started college.
Yeah.
To now, you know, nobody's making money. Like, people who used to make crazy money writing for people are making like a percentage of that now, a fraction of it.
Because of lack of mechanical.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's happening across the board. So again, it comes with adapting to the industry. Like, there's more ways to make money versus touring, recording, you know, or, you know, you're doing placements, doing music for video games. And, you know, you have to be able, again, to diversify yourself. That's why I program drums, play keys. You know, if someone says, can you do something? I say, yes.
Yeah.
Then I figure it out.
No, you have to. Anytime you own a business, you have to. Because, like, you know, I've had buddies, they're making a ton of money. All of a sudden, Google changes their algorithm. They literally have no business. You got to adapt. Mm-hmm. That's just the way. I think that, again, being self-employed for 20 years, change is your greatest asset, the ability to change, you know, and adapt.
Oh, yeah, without absolutely. A doubt. Yeah.
Hey, I got one more question for you. And I can't thank you enough. You've been really so genuine. I really appreciate that.
Wait, did you press record?
That's the first thing I, you know what?
Did you look down?
This has all been good. You know what? I got to tell you something. I had an interview one time with James Valentine, who's a guitar player from Maroon 5. And I'm in Tampa. An hour into the interview, we get this like, you know, a Florida storm, and the shit cuts out, the computer shuts off. It turns out that the software I had at the time, it was really weird. Like the software I'm using now, it's recording like contemporaneously as we're going. This other software, it was really weird. You had to push end and then it batched everything into the recording.
Oh, wow.
Well, when the thing zapped, there was nothing there. And I get back on and I'm like, God, you know, I feel just as bad if it was anybody, but it was James Valentine from Maroon 5. And like, I said, listen, man, I'm really sorry. I wish I could tell you something else. This happened. Is there any chance? And if you say no, that's totally good. I understand it. Can we pick this up maybe in like a month? So it's like fresh. And he goes, yeah, totally. I get it. And I was like, yeah, that was so cool of the guy. But no, to answer your question, yes, I always check that like right away. Why have you done an interview? Have you done a long interview like this? And it, like, oh my God, I forgot to hit record.
I've done recordings where I'm like, shit, that was a great part I just played. And I look up and I realize it didn't record.
No, that's the first thing I do. When I say, hey, welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, I always push that button right. And I got my eye on it constantly, believe me, in case, God forbid, it does shut down. But last question. What's been the biggest change in your personality over the last, let's say, 5 years? And how much of that change has just been like intentional on your end? And how much of it has been like just through, you know, getting a little older?
I'd say in the past 5 years, again, like I said, I've just kind of buckled down more and said no to more things just to allow myself space. So, and just definitely trying to know my worth as a player and as a person. So, that's what's changed about me is I don't just say yes to everything. I kind of can sift through bullshit now. And I'm not just talking about music. I'm talking about life.
Yeah.
I just know life is valuable. It's precious and that you can't get any of your time back. So if you're not really into something, you know, just kind of move on. Because otherwise you're going to have a lot of regret. So that's something that's definitely, I've been more focused on in the past 5 years.
Good for you. And I would love you to come on here in a couple of years and we'll see what's the next chapter going to unfold. Cause I know it's going to be really good stuff for you. So, let me tell people where to find you. First of all, Angie's got a new record that she's working on and there's a GoFundMe campaign for that. So I'm going to give you the link, but you could just go to GoFundMe.com and look up Angie Swan, but it's GoFundMe.com/ Angie Swan EP project. All right. GoFundMe.com/ Angie Swan EP project. Also, I want to say thank you to Joe Augello for the connection here.
My homeboy Joe.
And go to AngieSwan.com. And if you go to connect, if you're interested in either taking lessons with Angie or just inquiring with her to have her do some tracks or, you know, work on some jingles or music for you for film or television, go to AngieSwan.com and go to the connect button and just be descriptive and let her know what you're interested in, whether it's lessons or inquiries. And, you know, so she can get a frame of reference on is it something that makes sense for her? So she, instead of going back and forth 20 times on it.
And then dates and rates. That's all I need. Dates and rates.
Dates and rates. There you go. Let's break it down. And that's it, man. And I hope you come on here to talk about your new record when it comes out. Any final things we missed or anything like that?
No, I think we've touched just about everything.
Just literally. You know. Listen, thank you very
much. Let's not go there now.
Gotcha. Listen, thank you very much for everything. I really appreciate your time. This is real nice and I wish you nothing but good things and I expect nothing but good things for you. So
thank you, Craig. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Everybody, thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this interview, please share it with a friend on your social media channels. We appreciate your support with this. Thanks again to Angie Swan for spending time with us. Please support Angie and her music. Check out our GoFundMe campaign and just support whatever she's doing. Go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list so you and I can connect. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice. So choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode. And until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.